SRF 2 Kultur.
Das ist jetzt wieder hier in der Passage. Wir wiederholen Begegnungen, die innerhalb unserer Sendung Parlando stattgefunden haben und die uns besonders am Herzen liegen. So etwa die Begegnung mit der Sopranistin Emma Kirkby. Generationen sind mit dem Zauber der Stimme von Emma Kirkby aufgewachsen. Nachfolgenden Gesangsgenerationen war und ist die Britin Vorbild mit ihrem reinen, unangestrengt natürlichen Sopran. Wie sich Emma Kirkby, die mittlerweile im Herbst ihres Lebens steht, wie sich Emma Kirkby die Jugend ihrer Stimme erhalten hat? Patricia Moreno wollte unter anderem genau das wissen bei ihrem Treffen mit dieser Ikone der sogenannten alten Musik. Sie hören eine Wiederholung aus dem Jahr 2012.
When people say to me, you are right, in that sort of way, it makes me worry because they're implying everybody else is wrong. And I'm too British to say that. I don't like making these blanket statements. I just do what I do. And either it works or it doesn't. And if it feels true to me, then I'll stick with it. And if somebody else has a better way, well, good luck to them. I just do what I do and people make their own use of it. But I do admire people who use music very consciously for their joy and for their health. And I hear from people who say, you know, I was ill and this music made me feel better, or, well, it's not me, it's going to be Purcell or Bach or Hildegard of Bingen or whoever I was lucky to be recording. I'm just the vessel, I'm just the conveyor. The source is somewhere else.
Music for our hearts.
Henry Purcell, Music for a While. I'm just the vessel, I'm the conveyor, sagt Emma Kirkby. Ihre Stimme sei nur das Transportmittel, die Quelle liege woanders. Die Quelle für einen Gesang, der seit Generationen berührt, ein Sopran, der für viele der Inbegriff ist, einer Engelsstimme. So klar und rein, so natürlich im Klang, auch heute noch. Was vielleicht ein wenig unhöflich klingt, denn auf das Alter einer Dame spielt man bekanntlich ja nicht an, aber dass ihre Stimme mit 63 noch so jugendlich tönt, wie in dieser neueren Aufnahme, das ist schon bemerkenswert. Und für Emma Kirkby auch kein Tabuthema, schließlich hat sie noch immer einen vollen Konzertkalender zu bedienen, ist gerade in der Schweiz aufgetreten mit dem jungen Ensemble Charts. Zwischen Probe und Konzert ist Emma Kirkby so nett, ins Radiostudio nach Basel zu kommen. Was man ihr denn Gutes tun könne, will ich vorab wissen. Vielleicht eine Tasse Tee oder ein Sandwich? Oh, just a cup of hot water would be fine, sagt sie. Einfach eine Tasse mit heißem Wasser. Und damit sind wir eigentlich schon mittendrin. Beim Thema, wie Emma Kirkby ihre Stimme so geschmeidig halten konnte. Wie wichtig Feuchtigkeit ist und warum Klimaanlagen ihr größter Horror sind.
Well, I think hydration is a big, big deal. One is so often in air-conditioned places, places where the air is chosen for you by somebody else. And I am quite paranoid about that, especially in America. If I go to America, you know, I live in England, which up to now has been cool, temperate, oceanic. That's what I learned at school. Our climate was cool, temperate and oceanic. And it's a temperate climate. We don't need air conditioning in Britain. And then you go somewhere like Houston or Austin, Texas, gorgeous places. I've been lucky enough to be there in April, when the temperature outside is a gorgeous 17 degrees, and you have to put a coat on to get in a car or to go in a house. I cannot understand this. You know? But of course, I haven't endured their summers. I think they are traumatized by July and August or whatever. So they sort of step into freezers and live in them and then stay there, even when outside, you know, the weather is saying, come on, you can come out and enjoy this. But of course, everyone's different. Some people are absolutely fine on these things and others really suffer. And I just got to a point where I kept thinking I had some infections because I would try to sing and I couldn't get straight onto the note. There would be a little gap, you know. And I went to the throat doctor and he looked at the cords. He said, there's nothing wrong with them. They're just a bit dry. And try hydrating them. And at that time, he had some, I think it was iodine. You could swallow iodine. But, you know, you don't want to have too much of that, actually.
Also, sie sei jemand, der extrem auf Trockenheit reagiere. So extrem, dass sie einmal schon dachte, sie habe einen Infekt. Und der Hals-Nasen-Ohren-Arzt mit Blick auf ihre Stimmbänder beruhigte, nein, sie sind einfach nur ein bisschen trocken. Früher wurde gegen so etwas gern Jod verschrieben, Iodin. Aber das will man ja nun auch nicht in rauen Mengen schlucken, sagt Emma Kirkby. Sie hat inzwischen auch etwas viel Besseres gefunden. Ein kleines Ding namens Humidity Flyer, entwickelt von einem ehemaligen Air Qantas Flugbegleiter. Und das ist eine Feuchtigkeitsmaske, die ein bisschen aussieht wie ein Beatmungsgerät, aus dem auch noch Dampf aufsteigt. Komisch anzusehen, aber absolut wirksam gegen die extreme Trockenheit in Flugzeugen. Nie, so erzählt Emma Kirkby, nie werde sie einen Flug nach Südamerika vergessen mit der befreundeten Musikerin Alison Crumb, ihrer darmseitenbespannten Viola da Gamba und einem Feuchtigkeitsmesser.
I remember going to South America once with Alison Crumb, with her gamba, and she had one of those humidity counters with her. And we got off the plane at Recife. And on the plane, the humidity was like 9%, and we got off at Recife and the needle shot up to 70 or 80 and she said, ah, this is better. So, I mean, vocal cords, I'm not sure what the relationship is to gut strings, but there is some kind of correlation. They really do, I find that they respond very badly to dry conditions. And so I'm always trying to hydrate them. And I have to have no vanity at all on the plane because I use lovely little contraption made in Australia called a humidifier.
What is that?
Well, it was devised by a Qantas steward, someone who flew with the long-distance planes around Australia and around the world for some years, and he found the dry air really unpleasant. So when he left the airline, he started marketing these things called humidifiers. They look like hospital. It's a plastic mask over your nose and mouth with a little heat and moisture exchanger at the bottom. And what it does is recycle your own breath through the filter.
And so you wear that during the flight?
I do. You've got your little private steam bath. I mean, it's embarrassing. It looks, if you look, you know how in the plane, you look in the window, you can see your reflection. It's a terrible shock.
But you're incognito then.
Well, I sit in window seats to try not to upset too many people. Sometimes the stewardess will call by and say, are you all right? Because they think it might be oxygen and they haven't been warned that, you know, I'm at death's door. It's just my own breath. It's just humidity. And sometimes they say, oh, I wish I could do that. But it does, it looks awful. But a lot of singers have started to use it. And the dry air on those planes, it's absolutely deathly otherwise. It's just such a difficult thing to recover from.
Dem summenden Bienchen hinterher, ein Shakespeare-Song von Thomas Augustin Arne. Emma Kirkby weiß um die Dimensionen ihrer Stimme. Sie selber hat sich nie als Opernsängerin bezeichnet, raumfüllend habe sie nie gesungen. Und anfangs, Ende der 60er, Anfang der 70er Jahre, auch nie gedacht, dass das Singen für sie als Beruf in Frage käme. Sie sang so anders als die, die auf den großen Bühnen standen.
I just didn't think it was a possible option. It never occurred to me because professional singers sounded like so and I sounded like something else, you know. So I didn't think that I would ever fit into that world. And indeed, I didn't, because the world I found or that found me was a different one anyway. But I do feel very lucky, and I think what happened in the 70s, late 70s and 80s particularly, I think a whole lot of singers whose voices are, I would say, human scale, normal size, found chances to enjoy and sing fairly soloistically, but also in ensemble, in magnificent music, who could never have thought of being considered for the big time solo sounds, which were at the time very much louder.
Maybe it was the time, because it was the time of Joan Sutherland still, and this huge voices that mm-hmm. really can fill a whole arena. Yeah. You once said that you were there at the right time, at the right point, with the right musicians and the right friends.
Yes, completely lucky. And particularly, I mean, other voices, yes. I mean, choirs and small groups, I always adored that. But also I was doubly lucky because alongside me when I was a student at university were players of lutes and gambas and harpsichords and Renaissance wind instruments and Baroque violins. Everyone was trying new things, and those sounds just I didn't even have to think about it. They were just beautiful to hear, and one gave back instinctively a sound to go with them. And I do feel that the standard conservatoire recipe for a young singer's of the piano in the room, with that being the main thing you ever sing with for maybe 2 or 3 years when you're in your teenage, it's too loud. It's essentially too successful an instrument. It is its own world. The piano can be like a whole orchestra, but actually it doesn't sound like one. It sounds like itself. Mm. It's a very fine instrument for the music that's written for it. But you try and play on the piano a Bach cantata aria that should have, I don't know, a flute and 2 oboe da caccias and a cello and an organ. A piano cannot sound like that to save its life. It can't do it. And it will always be too round and continuous and too solid. And so a singer, in order to balance that, has to learn a certain level of voice. They never drop below this level when they sing. And it's too much for a teenager. I think I was incredibly lucky because I was either singing with other voices more or less the same size as mine, or I was singing with other instruments. And the lute in particular, that was my real gift. I was so lucky to be given that chance because the lute is a glorious instrument and it's the most fascinating thing to sing with and the most educational thing to sing with because nothing is hidden. You sing with the lute, every little tiny blip, every little tremolo, everything will show. You are really in touch with the core of your voice. You cannot escape it. Standing in front of a piano, a young singer, particularly soprano, in the middle, they can't compete. They're just not loud enough. So they neglect the middle because, quite rightly, they shouldn't try and compete at that point in the middle tones. So they just stay on the high notes, which will carry. And so they stay up with their top notes, but really don't develop their core sound. And you can do that much more easily with a guitar, with a lute, with any gentle accompaniment. I regret that so many students don't get the chance of that experience alongside all the other things they do. I'm not saying they should not sing with piano. I'm saying they should have the other experiences too.
Also Erfahrungen und Möglichkeiten im Plural, so wäre es ideal für junge Sängerinnen und Sänger. Aber doch ein bisschen ketzerisch nachgefragt, ob diese Skepsis vor modernen Klavier nicht doch ein wenig überzogen ist. Ein Schubert-Lied auf dem Konzertflügel begleitet, das ist doch gang und gäbe. Mag ja sein, gibt Emma Kirkby zu, aber...
Find them a fortepiano, find them Schubert's piano. It is half the dynamic of the modern one. And they'll be amazed, they will have more freedom. There will never be a balance problem. They will never have to struggle to get through and make that sort of hectoring sound to be heard. Of course, in the end, with a brilliant player, a piano can be a very subtle thing. But by the law of averages, most players are quite good. Most pianos are quite good. The average piano in a conservatoire, how many they have? I think Lausanne has, 170 pianos. They can't all be absolutely the best instruments in the world.
Yeah.
Why ask my fair one?
Emma Kirkby Haydn singend Fortepiano untermalt. Was die ganz junge Emma Kirkby, frisch von der Schule und eingeschrieben an der Universität von Oxford für alte Sprachen, was sie dachte, was sie einmal werden würde? Nun, Lehrerin wahrscheinlich. Im Unichor zu singen, wie sie es tat, das war für sie eigentlich nur klassisches Just for Fun.
I loved my Latin and Greek. I think I thought I might end up as a teacher. I loved singing for fun, but singing was what you did with other people for fun. It wasn't a serious professional occupation, I think. And still, as a student, the same. I was very lucky. As soon as I got to university, I joined this brilliant choir called the Schola Cantorum of Oxford, which is still going. It had its 50th anniversary concert a couple of years ago. You should have heard the choir that turned up and all these people who are now doing all sorts of other things. Yeah. And I do think that university, I'm sorry to say, it still remains, for certain kinds of singers, it remains the best music-making place. It's going to be better than conservatoire. It has to be, because you've got enough men. It's as simple as that. At university, you've got the tenors and basses who are going to end up as biochemists or doctors, you know, all these people who have these other vocations but are singing for joy and for fun. When I was a student and we joined this Europa Cantat sometimes, I seem to remember we made the best connections, I have to say, with the Danes and the Swedes that particular time. But there was a very embarrassing reason for that, which was that the Brits and the Swedes and the Danes, none of them were going to get up and do the Öffne Singen at 8 a.m. So we would meet at breakfast while the others were dutifully doing their singing at 8 a.m.
Aber gab es denn so etwas wie einen Moment, wo aus diesem Spaß ernst wurde oder zumindest so einen Moment der professionellen Initialzündung? Nicht wirklich, sagt Emma Kirkby.
Well, no, not really. I mean, it was more that I was starting to sing with some very good choirs that had some professionals already in them because they were people that had left the university and were doing further training with their voices, mostly the men actually. And those choirs, I mean, particularly Andrew Parrott's Taverner Choir, yeah. He kept of choice, he kept his women sort of students and straighter voices. And the women were amateurs because at that point, this was early 70s, your professional women singers were too operatic and didn't fit the sound that he wanted to hear. So he would have the young professional males and the amateur women, really, for his choirs. But it was a good standard and very exciting to do. I was doing that in the evenings while I was teaching in school.
Emma Kirkby hat tatsächlich einige Zeit lang unterrichtet als Lehrerin für Griechisch und Latein. Nicht lang, 2-3 Jahre, denn sie sang damals schon in Andrew Parrott's Taverner Choir mit seiner besonderen Mischung aus Studierten und aus Laiensängern. Parrott war auch ihr erster Mann. Doch es war eine Aufbruchszeit damals, Anfang der 70er Jahre. Irgendwann kam ein junger Lautenist des Weges, der nicht nur ihr Herz eroberte, sondern auch neue Wege aufzeigte.
Somebody came along, it was Anthony Rulli, and said, I have this Renaissance project. I'm looking for a particular sound. I think yours is it. He was doing a project called Music of Sundry Kinds, which was about domestic music making in various Renaissance countries. So there was England, Italy, and he wanted his four voices. He thought of the classic Renaissance idea of the four voices being like the four elements, earth, air, fire and water. Mm. And he had his three elements, but he didn't have his fire soprano.
You were the fire?
Well, yes. I mean, not that fiery. I was rather plain, really. But what I was doing was a sound that he could imagine balancing his lute, you see, and his gambas and rebecs, the sort of quieter sounds, because he was a lute player. He really wanted to try and get the singers back to the level of the instruments. So he wanted to pull singers away from the assumption that to be any good you had to be loud, and you can't hear the lute if you're too loud.
Thank you.
Orazio Vecchi, soben mica bon tempo. Und auch wenn sie hier eingebettet ist in ein Konzert der Stimmen, man hört ihren jungen Sopran doch heraus, den von Emma Kirkby. Viele Jahre lang sang sie im Concert of Music. Und die Vorstellung, allein zu singen, nein, das ist eigentlich immer noch nichts für sie.
I think the important thing is I was never alone. Once in my life I stood in a recording studio and sang completely on my own. It was Machaut Lay's. It was terrifying. I've never been alone in the studio before. If I were a, I don't know, Joni Mitchell with her guitar or something, they get used to it, you know, and they're on their own and they're creating their whole world of their own. And that to me is a very scary, courageous thing to do. And I've always got people to sing with. So although, of course, recording is different from live concerts because we lack that dynamic attention of an audience, we just have to give it to each other. That's how it works.
Emma Kirkby, ein Gruppenmensch und eine Ikone auch, dieser seinerzeit vor allem englischen Pioniergeneration der alten Musik. Christopher Hogwood, John Elliott Gardiner, Trevor Pinnock, das waren junge Leute damals, die versuchten, den Sound vergangener Zeiten zu rekreieren, die die historische Aufführungspraxis sozusagen erfanden. Wie sehr ist sie selber Expertin in diesen Dingen? Überhaupt nicht, sagt Emma Kirkby.
Absolutely not. I am not an expert and I suspect, in fact, I'm sure, that a lot of the young singers now who've been at the Schola and all these places, they know a great deal more than I do, and they've done a lot more research. I hope so. They've certainly got the chance to do it. And I was very lucky because I had enough people around just giving me hints. No, to be honest, I think I just worked it out by doing it, and I may be wrong about some things. I just found what worked for me, so I can't claim more than that.
In gewisser Weise ein Learning by Doing und ein sich Herantasten an das, was für einen selber am besten funktioniert. Da sei die heutige Generation, sagt Emma Kirkby, viel weiter. Die Möglichkeiten seien ganz andere. Und das fange schon mal bei den ganz anders sozialisierten Ohren der jungen Musiker heute an.
The biggest difference concerns what they heard when they were late teenagers. I think musical people that work away at their instrument and listen to other performances, what thrills them, say, between the age of 18 and 25, I think that stays with you. And my generation, particularly the instrumentalists, some of them were very brave. They thought outside the box. They read the books. They played their violins a different way. They shocked everyone else to start with. They maybe didn't sound quite as good as their contemporaries yet, but they got better at it and so on. But then, when they got quite good at playing that, and then they had the chance to play Beethoven with classical instruments, I remember how incredibly excited they all got. Mm-hmm. Because actually, that's what had thrilled them when they were teenagers. And they, with all of us at that age, the best performances you heard tended to be the conventional ones. And so now I think the difference is that the young people, they can hear the brilliant performances in the mainstream manner, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. They can also hear the brilliant performances of the historical players. They've got both in their awareness, whereas my generation, they didn't have anything to listen to aim for in that sense. They had to find their own way. That's the difference, I think. I've never liked the assumption there's only one way to do anything. I've never been able to cope with that. It's so fundamentalist. I don't see it that way.
Es gab sie durchaus, die Zeiten des so und nicht anders. Eine gewisse Halsstarrigkeit in der Szene der alten Musik, aber zum Glück sei die vorbei und sie habe ihr auch nie angehört, sagt Emma Kirkby. Allerdings gibt's auch bei ihr die Ausnahme von der Regel. Gibt's den Fall, wo sie sagt, ja, genau so und nicht mehr anders.
The one area I would stick my neck out and say, yeah, okay, we've now got it right when they had it wrong, is in singing of Bach cantatas. Because in the 70s, they were singing too high, the orchestras were playing too loud, and they were playing too slow. And so the voices trying to get these very airy, subtle lines going, too high, too loud, and too slow, was just exhausting. And only the titans managed it. And they did. I mean, Elly Ameling, Pai, Schreier, all those people were fantastic at it. But it was really hard, and only certain people could sing Bach, because you needed to be a racehorse. Nowadays, you know, you drop the pitch nearer what he had, you have light instruments, and you let the speeds get away and be lighter. And many, many people can sing Bach, because it's natural. Mm. So I think that is, I really would say, I take my hat off to the people in the 70s who still managed to make fabulous music. You can't kill Bach, ever. But, you know, it was such a struggle.
Emma Kirkby sang Bach. Zeit vielleicht auf ein grundlegendes Thema in der alten Musik zu kommen, die Tonhöhe. Im Konzertsaal heute treffen unsere Ohren für gewöhnlich auf 440 Hertz. Barockensembles liegen deutlich drunter, mal bei 430 oder bei 415 Hertz. 405 Hertz sei besonders für Purcell ideal, sagt Emma Kirkby und erklärt das mit der Verständlichkeit der Worte und warum Sopranen so häufig vorgeworfen wird, man verstehe ja gar nicht, was sie singen.
You can't make words clear above a certain level, particularly in the soprano. That top end of the voice has a different function. It's like a climactic effect, but it's not conveying a message, if you see what I mean. So depending on what the composer's after, I think these precise pitch differences are significant. If you take Carissimi pieces, he was in Rome. Rome was one tone below Venice at the same time. You know, to some extent, the internal evidence gives you an idea. If you take Monteverdi and do it at 415, it's desperate for the tenors. It's too low. Of course, some people are very flexible and some people can sing anything, but even so, in terms of listening, at a certain point, above a certain pitch, you don't hear the consonants so much. They get sort of enveloped by the vowels. And this is my excuse. People always say that, you know, sopranos, you can't hear their words and you can hear tenor words better. Well, they're lucky, aren't they? Because the tenor's consonants are high harmonics and they're popping up above the basic vowel sound, whereas with sopranos, if the pitch is too high, it makes it really hard.
Je höher geschraubt die Herzzahl, desto unverständlicher also das Wort bei den hohen Stimmen. Was einen auf ein interessantes anderes Phänomen bringt, das absolute Gehör, nun das sogenannte. Gibt es das überhaupt in Emma Kirkbys Ohren? Erneut, es kommt darauf an, wie sind die Ohren sozialisiert.
I think when people have perfect pitch these days, it usually is based on modern pitch or on the piano they grew up with. It's a matter of a very good memory. I think in those days, if you had perfect pitch, you would be even more precise and you would say, oh, I must be in Bologna now.
Really?
I think so. Well, there is a quote in Tosi. He was a retired castrato, I think, who wrote about singing. And it was translated into English in about 1740, I think, something like that. And he's, like a lot of these treatises, he's talking about musical notation as much as song. And he's saying, well, the tone, we have to know how the tone works. And some people say the tone is divided into 7 undiscernible parts. It's divided into 7 parts, but you can't tell them. That's quite wrong, says Tosi. Anyone can distinguish the 7th part of the tone. If they're not discernible, it must be 9 parts. So, you know, that was normal at his time. Actually, their sense of pitch was very, very exact. And if you then add the fact that it, in the string playing and everything else, with the way that they held their violins and so on, there was not so much automatic vibrato at the beginning of every note. There was vibrato, but the notes tended to start cleanly, so you knew exactly what pitch you were playing with, and so then you commit your dissonance with the next person. Mm. That lovely sort of semitone clashes that you get in Handel and so on, then they resolve. If there's a lot of vibrato, you're not going to get that dissonance. And I think you can assume that everything was started more cleanly, even if after a while the vibrato was then a glorious thing that you added to warm the note as it goes on. But if you have this clean start, then everything is easier. You hear the consonants more, you hear the pitches more clearly. You can distinguish the 7th part of a tone if you have to.
Dissonanz und Konsonanz bei Georg Friedrich Händel, diese Tonreibungen und Auflösungen, von denen Emma Kirkby zuvor gesprochen hat und die sie so sehr liebt. Überhaupt Händel. Er kam, sah und er sang sie gewissermaßen alle platt im England des frühen 18. Jahrhunderts. Denn mit ihm kam nicht nur der italienische Stil nach London, sondern kamen auch die italienischen Sänger, die Kastraten, die kapriziösen Diven. Umjubelte Stars, die bewundert und gleichzeitig aber misstrauisch beäugt wurden, als gesellschaftliche Exoten. Was war ein Sänger, eine Sängerin damals?
I think you were an exotic beast. And certainly in the generation just before, there were some very fine singers who couldn't go on the stage because it wouldn't have been proper for them. So they sang domestically. And those who did get on the stage had a wonderful time, but they were slightly suspect people. I don't know how long that lasted, actually, because right through, I mean, I remember when I was a child, there was sort of Noel Coward songs, no, don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington. You know, I think it was always a bit, you know, stagey people are always a bit suspect.
Nun vermutlich erübrigt sich die Frage, ob Emma Kirkby damals gern gelebt hätte, zu Händels Zeiten. Einer damaligen Sängerin allerdings fühlt sie sich dann doch besonders verbunden, hat vor Jahren sogar eine CD aufgenommen mit Arien, die für sie komponiert wurden. Cecilia Young, englische Sopranistin, die zunächst zu Händels Favoritinnen gehörte und dann von ihm fallen gelassen wurde, als sie es wagte, sich zu verheiraten. Ausgerechnet mit seinem Konkurrenten, Thomas Augustin Arne.
At that time she was British and the stars were Italian on the whole. And there are songs about it. There are songs talking about how, you know, this local person, she's fine, but she hasn't got a hope because someone's come from a sunnier clime is going to sing her off the stage. So it was a delicate time. And Cecilia Arne herself had a very tough time because her husband abandoned her as well. And, you know, it was she sang wonderful things, but actually her life was quite sad. And the British music, which had been so amazing in the time of Purcell and just after, got really marginalised when Handel arrived with his Italian singers. Well, they were wonderful. They were kind of so in your face and fantastic and exciting. So, of course, everybody rushed to hear them. And the English sort of, they fought back by being more subtle. I mean, John Gay wrote his Beggar's Opera and so on. These attempts to say, look, we have our own music making. But, you can't really argue with people who get excited by Italian singers because, especially if they sing as they speak, Italian's wonderful.
Rise, Glory, Rise. Eine Jubelarie, die Thomas Augustin Arne für seine Sopranistengattin Cecilia schrieb und ein bisschen auch zu Englands Ehren. Wozu Emma Kirkby auch das eine oder andere beisteuern kann, als Trägerin diverser Titel und Ehrungen. Doktorin honoris causa an ihrer einstigen Universität in Oxford und 2007 die vielleicht bedeutendste gesellschaftliche Anerkennung, die einem als Britin zuteilwerden kann, die Erhebung in den Adelsstand. Worüber Emma Kirkby heute noch den Kopf schüttelt, ich solle ja nicht wagen, sie Dame Emma zu nennen, wie es ihr eigentlich zustünde. Das Ganze sei schon ein bisschen absurd.
Our title system is obviously very eccentric. I mean, what is the British Empire anyway? An awful lot of people get an honour just for doing their job, you know. But in this case, I accepted these things. It's not something that means a lot to me, really. But my colleagues were very pleased as well. It was just a recognition that this way of music making is now not in a ghetto anymore. It's accepted as a viable way of making music that has an appreciable public and, you know, is part of our national life. I mean, my particular take on it is I feel I just represent a lot of other people who are quite pleased at the recognition. That's all you can say.
Really. But it's not that the Queen invites you for tea.
No, no. My son discovered that either the dame or the one before, which is called OBE, which is an officer of the what that means, I don't know. He said, oh, Mum, it means I could get married in St Paul's Cathedral if I wanted. Or is it Westminster Abbey, one or the other? But I doubt if he'll take up the offer.
Also ihr Sohn, scherzt Emma Kirkby, ihr Sohn werde wohl nicht Gebrauch machen vom Recht, in der St Paul's Cathedral zu heiraten oder was doch die Westminster Abbey? Na, egal. So egal, wie sie ihr ohnehin sind, all die Medaillen und Titel. Auf eine Auszeichnung ist Emma Kirkby dann aber doch noch stolz. Nicht, weil die Queen sie ihr tatsächlich ganz persönlich überreicht hat, sondern weil es Englands höchste Anerkennung für Musiker ist. Die Queen's Medal, ein Preis, der vom heutigen Hofkomponisten der Königin angeregt wurde.
Peter Maxwell Davies is our master of the Queen's music. And when he took up the office, he noted there were medals for art, for painting and for various other things, but not for music. So he just thought music should be represented. Yes. So they have a committee and they made this choice. And when I first heard about it, I thought, you know, because two big conductors, Colin Davis, Charles Mackerras, Bryn Terfel, much, much bigger voice than me. And I thought, where do I fit in? And then Catherine Tickell was the fifth one. She is a wonderful player of the Northumbrian small pipes and a folk singer, and she's brilliant, and she has really brought that beautiful folk instrument into the public eye and made wonderful sounds with it, but she remains very sort of simple in a way in her approach. And I thought, okay, then I could sort of fit alongside that. So I was the one after that, and I mean, it was, again, it was the same thing. It was I think that where I've had these things, I've been pleased when the explanation includes words like ensemble, team player, you know, that kind of thing, because that's how I see music. It's a social matter. It's not a question of solo glory. I'm really not interested in that at all.
Ballando da Capo. Im Rahmen unserer Sommerreihe hörten Sie die Wiederholung einer Begegnung aus dem Jahr 2012 zwischen Patricia Moreno und der Sopranistin Emma Kirkby.
Erfahren Sie mehr über unsere Sendungen auf unserer Homepage srf.ch.